top armour to Sky News South London.
So that was something that we got quite a lot of criticism for, because lots of people saying, but you should just march those guys straight down to the police station. What the hell are you doing? Why are you giving them airtime? But to me, it's not my job to be a policeman. It's my job to be a journalist and try and understand what's going on in our country and why so many kids did what they did. And there's quite a few things there, even going down to when he said cutting EMAs, so education maintenance allowances. That recently just happened before those riots. And it showed that there was a context to all this. It wasn't just mindless thuggery and opportunism. There was a thought process. Whether you agree or disagree with that thought process, most people will disagree. But actually understanding and listening to that thought process is quite important in working out what is going on in our society. So there's lots of questions about ethics and stuff that I'm sure we could kind of go into if you wanted to talk about it. But we designed that interview. It took me a day or two to get to the point where they came and met me on a beach, kind of on the banks of the Thames. But we designed it so I still, to this day, don't know who those four kids are. So we designed that interview in a way that they came and met us, and I went through a process with them of talking to them before we started doing the interview, so that I was happy that they had done what they said they had done. But I still don't know who they were. All I know is that, as far as I'm aware, they've never been arrested for what happened in those riots.
How did you find them then?
Yeah.
If you don't know who they are.
That's a very good question. Journalists have contacts.
Oh.
And that's one of the things that all of you will already have contacts and people that can help you with things or tell you stuff that's going on. And that was through a process of, of going back through a few people that I'd worked with previously in the kind of 6 months, a year before, in that part of South London, who I knew would have a pretty good idea of, if not who some of those kids were, but would know someone who knew someone. And so it's just a question of kind of going back to those contacts and saying, look, I want to speak to these people, and what can you do? And it took quite a bit of negotiation and convincing them that, A, it wasn't a trap, so that we would hand them into the police. But because I was trusted kind of by those contacts, they knew that I wasn't going to screw them over and dump them into a police station custody.
Police
suite.
Know,
They didn't on that one, actually, no. The Met Police would have been monitoring, because they monitor and record all of our output, so no doubt they were looking at it very closely, but they didn't actually speak to me directly afterwards. I was fully expecting them to do that, and the reason that we designed it so that I didn't know who those kids were was because my job is not to be a police informant. My job is to try and understand what's going on. So I personally didn't want to know the kids' identities, but I did want to be absolutely sure that what they were telling me was accurate, truthful, whether or not 100% of what they said, whether some of it was embellished or bravado or whatever. Did he actually get the nappies? Did he actually get the powder and all that kind of stuff? I've got no way of proving that, but I'm convinced that they were doing what they were said they were doing. It's a judgment call, and you, as journalists, you make judgment calls all the time, because accuracy and being truthful is, if you're not that, then you're nothing really as a journalist, and kind of fake news is a whole new kind of frontier of that. But making a judgment call, trying to think, okay, are these guys genuine? And I was convinced that they were. And we spent an hour with them, or half an hour with them before we filmed anything, and then an hour with them talking to me for an hour, and there was nothing in that hour of them talking to me. And you can generally work people out, and you can become more honed at doing that. You can work out if people are blagging you, generally.
What did you ask them to make sure that they was actually not stealing what they were saying?
We talked them a lot about where they'd been, and asked different ones of them at different stages to see if their stories matched up. And we talked about kind of what kind of stuff they'd stolen. We just went through kind of one of the days or evenings they said they were in a certain place, and we went away and just double checked that was actually happening in that place at that time, and it was. So it's just putting together a kind of jigsaw almost, and making, as you said, a judgment call as to whether you think think that it's right or not. Because there are, you've got to be really careful. I did my dissertation at Bournemouth University on hoaxing the media. And that was a really interesting thing to look at as to why people would hoax the media or try to kind of create news or create something for a certain agenda. So it's perhaps something I'm a bit more aware of than other journalists, but it's an easy trap for people for whatever reason can try and kind of get stuff in the news for all sorts of different agendas, and sometimes it's complete rubbish. So the Looters one was particularly one that we got a lot of criticism for, but I felt, my bosses felt, that it was something that was vitally important that we looked at. It's a bit of a nightmare because we recorded the thing one evening, and then we got it on the breakfast news that morning. It ran all day, and then all of a sudden at lunchtime they decided they wanted a half-hour special, so we kind of were frantically editing all afternoon, and what we called hot rolled, so you kind of get it ready in the edit suite, and we didn't have time to publish it to a server, so we had to effectively hit the space bar, let it roll, and it was a 13-minute segment that went live on telly, kind of straight from the computer, which is not really the best way of doing things, but it just proved how close up to the wire we pushed it, because it was a frantic effort to get a half-hour programme ready rather than just a 3 or 4 minute news report, which is kind of the normal kind of day-to-day stuff that we do. Any other questions about anything that, yeah?
You know the one with the child one, how do you how do you not get involved in a way? Because I don't know about you, but if I were to see that, I'd go rip that man off the child and beat the crap out of him and from the child. But yeah, how do you make judgment calls on where you should intervene or not?
Really hard, really hard. And I know that there are loads of examples of journalists over the years who have kind of blurred the lines. So there's a famous ITV journalist, I think, who adopted a kid from the Balkans, because during the reporting of the Balkans War in the 90s, he got really attached to what was happening to that one particular child, and he actually ended up adopting that child. And there are loads of when I worked for ITV, we went to Pakistan to do an earthquake, and I also went to do the tsunami in Thailand, on the Boxing Day tsunami, when 250,000 people were killed. And you're looking at it and you're thinking, what can I do as a human being? I'm a journalist, but I'm a human being here seeing these kids in... And you've got to remember that what you are doing in terms of telling other people about what's going on is a service to those people. And if you're doing it well and fairly and kind of in a responsible manner, then it is a very good service that you're doing that will lead to aid donations, quite possibly. In the tsunami, we did a piece on a school that was completely demolished. People watched it on ITV Central, which is where I was working at the time. There was a big fundraising effort actually here in the Midlands, and that school was partly rebuilt because of the report that we'd done that night that just went on Central News at 6 one night, which was quite a nice thing to happen, because it's not something that I've directly affected by my actions, but it's an indirect consequence of that report going on TV. And we're in Pakistan doing earthquake, and we left, we had tents, because there were no buildings left in that particular part of Pakistan. We just left our kit with a family who needed it, so they had a tent for the next 6 months to get them through the winter, but it was better than what they had we not done that. So it comes back to being a judgment call, and you can only do what you can do, and you've got to remember that what you're there to do is to tell other people about what's going on. But it's hard, and you see some really tough stuff. We saw some really horrible stuff in the tsunami in Thailand, of open air morgues and this kind of stuff, and it does take you aback at times. And you do develop as a journalist quite a thick skin sometimes to be able to deal with stuff. Where even stories at home, when it's a young child who's died for whatever reason in horrible circumstance, that can really get to you sometimes. I became a dad 2 years ago, and it does kind of change your mindset a little bit. But you do, as a journalist, sometimes need a thick skin, A, to be able to ask the difficult questions sometimes, when you know that the person you're asking doesn't necessarily want that question to be asked, whether it's about child poverty, or whether it's a politician who's done something bad, or whether it's a football club who've got some reason to have some kind of scandal there. Most football journalists don't ask difficult questions because they need the access at that football club to continue. So a thick skin for asking questions, but also a thick skin for being able to deal with some pretty horrible stuff that happens in our world. So it's something that you do need to be aware that anything, it comes back to that thing of anything can happen, and being able to deal with that and adapt and work out A, how you're going to tell the story, and B, how you're going to deal with it personally, is quite a big kind of thing that everyone has their own little way of working out, but it's an important thing to try and realise that you might be exposed to some pretty horrible stuff in life. Yeah.
Do you think that If you're asking people difficult questions, though, like, obviously it depends on the story, but if it was a story like a family's just lost their child, and you're asking the difficult questions because you know it's going to make a good story, they can just as easily be like, why?
Yeah, of course. Yeah, absolutely.
Story, so
it comes back to judgment call again. And different journalists will deal with different situations. Let's take the example of a child being... there's one I did in Liverpool quite a few years ago where a young lad was shot dead by some gangs that had targeted the wrong person, had shot, a bullet had deflected and killed an 11-year-old boy who was walking to football training. A guy called, little kid called Reece Jones. Dreadful, dreadful story. And every family will deal with that in different ways. A lot of the time they'll want to close themselves away, grieve completely personally, don't want anything to do with the media. And then there are other situations where the police will think, we need this family to make an appeal because we've not solved this and that killer is still out there. And so therefore they may get put forward for interview. There may be occasion where, as a journalist, you have to go and do what is known pretty crudely as a death knock, where you go and knock on the door sometimes of a family where that's happened. And again, it comes down to judgment calls. If you pull up outside a house, do you go in immediately and knock on the door and keep knocking until you get an answer? Is that the right thing to do? Or do you perhaps wait and see someone who's come out and make a judgment call as to whether that person looks like they are grief-stricken and doesn't want to talk to anyone? Or do they look kind of as though it's perhaps an uncle who's come to visit, who's perhaps in a slightly better place than the other people in the family, who might be the person to go and have a quiet word with without a camera, without kind of a microphone, and just on a human level just saying, I'm really, really sorry, this is a really tough situation. We're here from Sky News. We're reporting what's going on because it's such a big thing. I don't want to intrude on the family's grief, but if you did want to say anything, then we're here. Perhaps this is my card. If it's a no, just let us know and we'll leave. But that would be my way of dealing with it. But that's kind of, again, comes down to individual perspective on how you deal with people. And one of the things that Paul and I were talking about earlier was, in all this kind of fast-moving media, where kind of there's all these different platforms and you're trying to tailor your content to different platforms and different audiences, and you're trying to get your head around whether it's Snapchat or how a story's going to be told on a Facebook Live or whatever, it often just comes back to being a human being and talking to people and actually listening to people and trying to ask questions delicately and remembering that you actually find stories out from people rather than from a Google search bar. And sometimes when something's happened, the only way you can find out what's happened is to go and knock on a door in a road where something's happened, or to try and find the eyewitness that has got the most amazing bit of video footage of what's just happened, just because they recorded it on their phone. And that actually, you don't find that by typing something into a search engine on your phone. Sometimes you've got to remember, stories are always about people, whether it's an animal story or whatever. It always comes back to people and what they do. And you find stuff out by talking to people best, I find. There's certainly many examples through my career where we've gone off and found something on an estate, or found something out, or found that bit of footage that someone's got because they filmed it from their balcony. But you only do that by actually going out and physically meeting people. And so you've got to be able to talk to people as well as message them or email them, because it's a really important skill to kind of, A, get people to trust you. Like when we came back to those looters, the kind of contacts that we've worked with before trusted me, and so therefore they could tell those four lads that he's not going to screw you over and he's not going to turn up with the police. But they still took quite a big risk by turning up on that beach that day. And as far as I know, they weren't caught. But I don't know who they were. I think even one of them ended up going off to university and has made quite a good do of his life. Managed to kind of put his misdemeanours behind him, I think. But so it always comes back to kind of judgment calls and dealing with people and kind of respecting people. Because if you were at the centre of one of those stories, you'd want at least basic minimum respect from a journalist who was knocking on your family's door or on your mum's door, kind of when something awful has happened, kind of in the street or whatever. You've got to remember that people are still people who need to be respected. And journalism sometimes does get quite a bad rap from the kind of operators in our industry who kind of push the boundaries quite hard and photographers who overstep the line sometimes, and there's been quite a move to make sure that the industry is a bit better regulated and that those rogue operators are not out there, because they give all journalists a bit of a bad reputation. So it's kind of something to bear in mind, that you've got to be nice to people sometimes to get good stuff. And that's easier if it's genuine and you're genuinely nice to people rather than just schmarming and trying to get something blamed because you're smiling at them. And sometimes it just pays to be nice to people. And sometimes, one example of that, we were in Sheffield, horrible murder of a guy in his 80s, church-going guy, completely senseless murder. We were there at the end of the day. It was a weekend. It wasn't that busy a news weekend, so we did it as a story. And the widow came up to the spot where we were broadcasting to lay a flower. And I could see that she was all over the place, lady in her 70s. And I said to our cameraman, just turn the camera away. Just so we kind of didn't film her, let her go and do what she wanted to do. And afterwards I went and spoke to the woman who was with her and just said, look, from the press, I just want to let you know we didn't film that. Kind of, this is my business card. If you want to talk at any point in the future, just let me know. But I just didn't feel that it was the right time. It only happened 12 hours earlier. And then I had a call from the following week. We did a big interview with the widow, and she actually asked us to do the be the host broadcaster for the funeral. So kind of, she said that one act of kindness changed kind of what I thought about the media. So there's lots of things that you don't see in the news that actually you've just got to be kind of accountable to yourself, I suppose, and to make sure that you can sleep at bed, in your bed at night, not while you're watching your new plasma, but there came out some great quotes. And on that interview, actually, there's an Australian band called The Temper Trap who were in London at the time. And they did a song called London's Burning, and they sampled my interview in their track. So if you ever want to look up London's Burning as a track from The Temper Trap, we're in it. And they invited us to their gig in London, in Camden, the year afterwards. And they opened up their set with 3,000 or 4,000 people in this club, with my voice asking some of those questions, which was really surreal, but quite cool. So, it's kind of lives on in a song, that interview. So, lots of ethical kind of things and judgments to take into account when you're dealing with that kind of people, basically, who have been at the heart of a massive story. But hearing from them, I feel is still a valuable thing, and reminds people that it's not just kids who are out to riot, but actually there's kids who are thinking about why they're rioting and using it as a justification. So, yeah.
Could you talk a bit about the questions that you did ask them? Because I think one of the really valuable things about that interview is that you're having to put some quite tough questions to them, which quite often are questions that are about what other people are saying, not your own beliefs. So it's not necessarily you saying that they are this and the other.
Yeah, I mean,
yeah,
it's hard when... I've done quite a lot where we've looked at criminal issues and crime stories, and you do have to kind of have a bit of a different strategy rather than just going and doing a regular interview with whoever, expert at university, for example. But the way in which we did that, I was kind of making up as I was going along, based purely on the fact that I thought, well, we didn't know whether they were going to stay for 30 seconds or 30 minutes. And in the end, they stayed for about an hour, which I was amazed at. So I had to kind of keep thinking of questions, because I was thinking, this is good. This is really interesting that what they're saying. And so I just had to keep reminding myself that you have almost got to play the role of kind of the most angry viewer and think about, well, what are the people watching this going to be thinking? And there was one question in there where I said, well, so it's down to the government to sort out your life to make sure that you don't go out looting. And it's kind of just trying to be quite hard on them, because I know that if we just gave them an open platform, that's not journalism, or you've got to sometimes think, what's the difficult question and why, what kind of reaction will we get if we just give them 2 minutes of airtime to chat, because that's just not what we should be about in terms of challenging behaviour, because everyone knew that the rioting was way over the line of what was acceptable, but still listening to the justification is quite interesting. So
do you have to then ease into those kind of questions, though? Because obviously, if you ask something like that.
Yeah, and you'll find with every, it comes back to judgment calls. Every interview you do, you'll work out as you go along. Sometimes, kind of, when I started out as a journalist, I know that how reassuring it is to have a list of questions so that you don't miss anything. But quite often, interviews go in completely different directions. We were doing Facebook Live at Twycross Zoo on Sunday. So zoos have been in the news a lot recently, with that one in Cumbria, one in Paris 2 weeks ago where a rhino had its horn chopped off after thieves broke in. So we thought it'd be quite good to go to a zoo for the day and just ask the question about, well, what are zoos for now? And are they relevant and the rest of it? So Twycross Zoo in Leicestershire let us in. And we were doing a Facebook Live, and this woman I was interviewing from the zoo mentioned about conservation, and even things like contraception. I thought, that's interesting. Do you use condoms with giraffes? I mean, like, how does that work? And so I asked her in this Facebook Live, and then it kind of provided a really kind of quite entertaining answer as to what was going on with how you do birth control with elephants and everything else. So quite often interviews go in different directions just purely based on your kind of instinct as something that's interesting. Yeah.
And how do you do birth control?
I can't remember. I think it's about, you put males in a group separately to females, and then you can actually give them the pill as well.
So segregation.
Yeah, segregation, but you can give them the pill.
For abstinence.
Yeah, exactly. It always comes back to not just thinking, okay, I've got, what's my next question I've got written down on my pad, but listening to what someone's saying to you and thinking, oh, I didn't quite realise that before we did the interview. I didn't have that on my list of questions, but that's really interesting. And you'll just, by doing it more and more often, you just get more confident in thinking, okay, well, let's just ask about that then, because I find that interesting, what that person's just said. So it comes back to listening to people quite often and kind of being open-minded, because you never quite know what's going to happen or where an interview's going to go, but kind of giving people the freedom to speak. And also comes back to being nice to people. If they feel comfortable talking to you, they're going to open up a bit more than them thinking this person's a bit of a whatever. Because you want them to be comfortable in when they're talking to you, whether it's for radio, whether it's for TV, or even for a print interview or online interview, that you kind of put people at ease and kind of warm and welcoming, because if they're kind of comfortable talking to you, they're going to give you better answers and perhaps tell you things that you hadn't realised. Quite often, what you hadn't realised could be the story that is leading the news at the end of the day, rather than what you initially thought it was going to be as you kind of thought about what questions you might ask. So I'd always say, have a few questions in mind, but don't be afraid to just talk to people and have a discussion, and take it in whichever direction you feel is perhaps the most interesting thing to look at. The contraception thing was a bit weird, but it was quite entertaining for a Facebook Live, which is something we've done a lot more of, and we just try to make sure that they are much more accessible, much more interactive with people's comments, and we make sure that we filter quite a few of the comments to the journalists doing the Facebook Live, so that we can reflect that and put some of the questions of the audience to the people doing the interview. And that's something that's kind of a bit of a new thing for us over the last year and a half, where we've used Facebook Live to try and give a more informal, kind of in-depth look at some of the issues that we're looking at, and also something that's much more interactive. We started off just doing them literally recorded on a mobile phone, and now we do it on the main kind of cameras through a satellite link, that and they just filter it through our main headquarters in London onto our Facebook site. But you get kind of 70, 80,000 people watching some of those sometimes, which could be during a quiet period of the day, just as many or if not more than people who are watching Sky News on the telly. That's kind of one area that we're working on quite a lot at the moment to make sure they're as good as they can be. Any other questions or anything else? Or
you know, you said like you went to Paris just after the attacks, and obviously being in the Middle East. Are you just sitting there when you give them a choice? Because I imagine like you're on age like 24/7, and I wouldn't feel comfortable doing that.
Yeah, I mean, you get used to being sent to different stories just through experience. So it would feel weird to, I mean, I've got my passport in there, I've got an overnight bag in my car, and literally I could get the call to say, okay, you're going here and you'll probably be away for a week, and that's just the deal. But then you normally go into an incredible story. So with Paris, it was 9 o'clock on a Friday night, it started to become apparent that it was a serious attack in Paris that was above and beyond what we'd seen before. So I phoned up the news desk, and it was just pandemonium, as you could probably imagine, when they're trying to scramble to a story instantly and trying to get people on air instantly. And even in those first moments, it could be just someone on the phone, as basic as that in the kind of technological era that we live. Someone on the phone describing what's happened can be just as powerful as in the first hour or two. But I phoned up the news desk and said, do you want me to go? I'm on shift this weekend. I can get there. And they said, if you can book a flight, go. So it was kind of almost my call, which is quite unusual, because normally it's a news editor who's saying, right, we need to do this, we want to do this story. And so I just got on the website, booked the first flight out of Birmingham Airport that morning, which was 6:30. I was at the Bataclan Theatre by 9 o'clock, with blood still on the pavements, and just a chaotic kind of scene that was repeated over and over again at these different sites of pretty much mass murder that had happened literally that night. And we stayed all week, and we did kind of rolling coverage, lots of live reporting, a bit of in-depth stuff where we tried to go off and try and find the story away from what everyone else was doing. So we went up to Saint-Denis, which is where they had that, there was a big siege about 3 or 4 days after the massacres, when kind of they cornered the people involved. We managed to find a woman up in Saint-Denis who told us that she'd seen the main ringleader and his kind of gang kind of out smoking weed and drinking alcohol on the street on the Saturday after the attacks. So that gave a really interesting insight into the fact that this gang who had brought terror to the streets of Europe were casually on the street the day after in Paris, still there, still among the community, still presumably with the weapons or whatever that they'd used the night before. And that interview kind of went kind of all around the world as well, once we put it on Sky News at 5 o'clock that evening. So, and then kind of freaked out the woman who'd given us the interview, because it went so big because of such global interest in what was happening in Paris at that time. So we had to kind of do a lot of work calming her and making sure that she was aware that the police may want to talk to her about what she'd told us. But we would do everything that we could to make sure that she was in a position where she wasn't kind of identified by, because she didn't want her surname to be connected to the piece, so we made sure that didn't appear on any of our platforms, and therefore everyone else who took the story on didn't have her surname, which gave her a degree of protection in terms of people weren't on her doorstep trying to find her. So